There we go. Sorry, I just had to get this little recorder going. Well, good to see everybody. I hope you're all doing well on these foggy days. It's been kind of foggy up here in the heights of Mission, although at times we've had also beautiful clear skies as well. I've always liked the fog. I grew up in Calgary, as probably a lot of you know, and we didn't have much fog there. And so when I first moved to Vancouver and experienced the fog, I was mesmerized. I thought it was beautiful and would often go hiking when I could in the foggy North Shore Mountains when it was there. Well, as Carmen mentioned, this is the second class on the Genjo Koan. And I encouraged last week everyone to kind of download to download the Genjo Koan itself. It's available. I just put the link also in the chat to everybody if you haven't already. And I encourage you to look it over, to read it. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along here. So for those of you who maybe are new to this kind of text, I think it's really important, and maybe I already said this last week, but we cannot approach this kind of text with the idea that we're going to quickly understand it. That we're going to, you know, kind of pick up what Dogen is trying to tell us. Like we might say, for example, read a text on photosynthesis or on how to install a new computer program on our laptop. I think it's much more appropriate to approach Dogen like a new and unusual painting, or a difficult piece of music, or perhaps a little bit of a challenging poem. That way. Dogen's writings, and indeed I think, you know, all the sutras pretty well, are not maps in a kind of conventional sense. Although they're very helpful as we kind of navigate the Buddha way. Dogen's writings are more like prods and encouragements, challenging us to question and to deeply examine our own experience. That's what Dogen wants us to do. He wants us to really examine carefully our own experience. And as you may know, when we investigate our own experience, this usually leads to questions, and then to more questions. And we enter in this way into a kind of unknown territory. And in that place, we learn that questions are far more important, far more moving than whatever answers we receive. That it's questions that will take us closer to our home, our true home, not the answers. So I'm going to try to screen share again so we can follow the text and I'll talk. I hope this will work. And Carmen, let me know if for some reason this doesn't work. I need to do a kind of advanced sharing here, which I'm not very advanced on this at all. Portion of the screen, okay. Carmen, does that work? Can you see number one, number two? And can you see me? Oh, excellent. Thank you, everybody. So just a quick review of the first kind of paragraph. When we look at the Japanese, I should mention there's no breaks. These were put in by the translator, Kaz Tanahashi, and Robert Akinroshi. They translated this, I think, together. To help us approach and understand the Genjo Koan But paragraphs don't exist in Japanese language, in the traditional Japanese language, in the same way that they exist in English. And so, let me just read it quickly here. As all things are Buddha Dharma, there are delusion, realization, practice, birth, and death. Buddhas and sentient beings, as myriad things are without an abiding self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient being, no birth, no death. The Buddha way, in essence, is leaping clear of abundance and lack. Thus, there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. Yet, in attachment, blossoms fall, and in aversion, weeds spread. So this first paragraph, just to quickly summarize what we talked about last week, is kind of the view of the world as we go about our everyday life. Mostly, we go around our everyday life with a view of kind of bias, discriminations, likes and dislikes. It's basically the view that we are separate, the separateness of self from all the myriad things that make up this universe. Mine, not mine, black, white, desirable, not desirable, painful, pleasant, praise, blame, etc. Dogen illustrates this idea of separateness with notions of delusion and awakening, Buddhas and the rest of us, that kind of thing. So this first line particularly is the view that I'm here, I'm like this, and I need to get there, and I need to be like that. So in a way, I was thinking about this. This is the view of how we, most of us, begin our practice. We find ourselves in a web of dissatisfaction and suffering, and we seek a way out of this mess that we find ourselves in. So it's kind of like we stand at the very beginning of spiritual practice with this kind of conundrum. And then, as time goes on, something changes. So in the next kind of line there, Dogen gives us a second view, which is just as true as the first, the view of emptiness or of oneness, that the flower and the compost and horse manure that nourishes the flower, those things are not separate. They are really one. And from this position of oneness, there is no thing that we call birth or death, Buddha or sentient beings, because there is no self which separates me from the other. So how could there be Buddha or sentient being? There's just one. So at first glance, this may seem to be the very opposite of the first line, but let's not judge that quite at this moment. Because the third sentence elucidates the view of practice. That is, not becoming entangled in abundance, all the myriad things that are separate from me, that view. And that's the whole truth of the universe. Everything's separate, everything's all those little bits and pieces floating around this great universe. Don't get caught there. And also, don't get caught by this experience or sense or understanding of emptiness, oneness, and think, well, that's the true reality. That's the whole of it. Everything is one. Don't get caught there either. Not in abundance or lack. Becoming intimate with both, or as Dogen puts it much better, leaping clear beyond both, our life unfolds then. Yes, in the midst of birth and death, delusion and realization. But our living is radically transformed, freed from any kind of clinging to birth and death, delusion and realization. We are just in this endless, beautiful dance of transformation. And then in the last line, attachment blossoms fall and weeds spread. Dogen beautifully expresses how we ordinarily experience our world, full of blossoms and weeds, yearnings and aversions, and the pain of life as we yearn for what disappears and what we don't want keeps coming up. So in a way, this is the First Noble Truth, as well as the whole view, the whole Buddhist view, kind of Dogen poetically puts it in this first paragraph. But tonight, let's go on, and we'll look at some more paragraphs here, and I'm going to start with the next one. To carry the self forward and illuminate myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and illuminate the self is awakening. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. Further, there are those who continue realizing beyond realization, who are in delusion throughout delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddha. Well, this is one of the most famous passages in all the writings of Dogen. And it's kind of one of my favorites. Here, Dogen has us consider awakening and delusion using language, I think, in a rather playful way, but still challenging us. Challenging our common understanding that delusion must be banished in order for us to awaken, for us to be experience enlightenment. So let's just kind of look at this line by line for a moment here. To carry the self forward and illuminate the myriad things is delusion. Well, this is I think very beautiful line, saying this is how we live our life usually, self-centered, and it's all reference to me, right? I carry myself forward and looking at all these kind of things that are around me. It's kind of business as usual, right? Getting up in the morning, struggling to make a living, getting my needs and wants met, carrying myself into the world and knocking away what kind of seems harmful or obstructive, and hanging on to what seems pleasant and good. Seeing oneself more or less as separate from the rest of the world, and the struggle necessary with the world to get personal desires fulfilled. We make great effort, I think all of us at some point, we make great effort to understand life and the world with our ideas, our abilities, the work that we do. And that's helpful, but it's not enough. Unless we enter into intimacy and connection, we will never understand our life and we'll never understand the world. And this Dogen then picks up in the next line, that myriad things come forth and illuminate the self is awakening. I think we can all agree that even with a brief reflection, we can see that the whole universe, from the very beginning through an endless chain of causes and conditions, brought you, brought me, into being, into this place at this time. And this whole universe really endlessly supports us. The great folk songwriter Joni Mitchell wrote, "We are stardust, we are golden." You probably don't remember that song. "We are stardust, we are golden." And it's true that researching this, that nearly all the elements in the human body, there's just a few that aren't, almost all the elements were made in a star. So when we look closely in our practice, in our Zazen practice particularly, looking closely, and we'll explain what that actually means in terms of Dogen, the commonly viewed boundaries between things becomes kind of blurry. Those boundaries become very permeable. For example, we can't find the exact boundary between the in-breath and the out-breath. Look closely and you see it's a little hard to find any kind of real clear boundary there. And when we look closely, to use Thich Nhat Hanh's very famous image, we can't find the boundary between the compost and the flower. They merge. And where exactly is that boundary when we put the compost on the base of the flower, or the plant and what, and the flower comes? Or even between the finger and the palm, between the unborn child and the mother, where exactly is the boundary? And this is true for all things. The true self, the kind of big self, the complete self, is not illuminated by our ideas, beliefs, and assumptions. It is really illuminated by dropping those ideas, beliefs, and assumptions, and allowing then the truth that the myriad things that we see around us and us, the self, are not two. In this, in the Japanese, the word self, in this illuminate the self is awakened. The Japanese word is jiko, which jiko is kind of like the boundless self. Or sometimes it's some scholars refer to it as self of all things. So maybe you could say self with a capital S. But that would be to make it special, in a way separate from the self with a small s. And that would make it separate, which is not what any of this is about. So awakening, Dogen is telling us, is to allow the unfolding of our full life without grasping or pushing away. Life simply experiencing itself undivided. No driver in the driver's seat, so to speak. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. This is a hoot. I think this is a great line. Dogen tells us that the great realization or awakening is simply awakening to how we delude ourselves. That we don't see the fullness of our reality that has always been present. Awakening is intimacy with delusion. Four decades ago, I read a book that described the various awakening experiences by some people that had during, you know, longer retreats. And I wish I had never read that damn book, because that sparked in my imagination about awakening, what awakening is and what it should be like. That there'd be some great spiritual event that will shoot me into a different and greater reality. Like kind of out of a cannon, right? Boom! One of perfect unity, and I would be free forever from my whining ego. But Dogen tells us very clearly, here and in other places, that the moment of awakening, there is no one who realizes. there's just life, fully being life. So rather than waking up to our imagined better world, we wake up from our own dream. We wake up to the full nature of our life that has always been present. When we become intimate with our delusions, they no longer pull and push us. There's a story in the Lotus Sutra, the Lotus Sutra being perhaps the most famous sutra or Buddhist text in the East Asian Buddhist tradition. Anyway, there's a story about, or kind of parable, I guess, of an impoverished person who visits a very wealthy friend. And they become drunk, as friends are sometimes want to do, and they fall asleep. And the wealthy friend must go on a business trip early next morning. But before leaving, sews a jewel into the lining of the poor friend's robe. And the poor friend wakes up later, and over the next while, his life encounters great hardship, always being in want. And later, it's not clear how much later, but the two friends meet, and the poor friend learns about the jewel that has always been in his robe. So although he had wealth, he lived poor. Now, I realize this parable, like all parables, is not a perfect analogy to our life. But I think we can appreciate that while the poor friend's experience before and after realizing wealth was probably different, or would be different, the reality of his wealth had always been present, even though he was unaware of it. I think this is one of Dogen's key points. He stresses over and over in his writings, the nature of your true and full self is always present, always, and has always been present. So he goes on further. There are those who continue realizing beyond realization, who are in delusion throughout delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddha. Well, here Dogen gives us another hint that realization is neither a place nor a state. Realization, Dogen says, is beyond the duality we imagine of realization versus delusion. Realization is leaping clear of abundance and lack, leaping clear of flowers and weeds. For this reason, as soon as we're aware of realization, like, oh, it's kind of like, oops, what was that experience I just had? We are back simply as sentient beings, so to speak, inhabiting the world of delusion. And at times, stuck in delusion, we may assume that that's all there is. This is all there is to life, right? All these myriad things. I need to get my boat, my car, my fancy house. Delusion upon delusion. And many live in delusion upon delusion, of course, in our consumer-focused society. Kind of like Mara, the tempter, in the early Buddhist texts. Our consumer-focused society keeps trying to seduce us into grasping the next best thing. So in this text, Dogen says one more thing that's kind of a little bit surprising, perhaps. He writes, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice they are Buddhas. Buddhas do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. I think what he's saying here, They do not compare being Buddha with being a sentient being. Buddhas don't think of themselves as being special. It's not necessary to be aware or cognizant of awakening because, as Dogen writes, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddha. In other words, it's not like a one-time pow event. And I don't think this is strange. I think it is perhaps similar to being in the flow, to use an expression. Like in the flow when you're skiing downhill, or in the flow when you're playing music on your guitar or writing poetry. That sense of me doing it, right, just falls away. It's just the music playing. It's just skiing down the hill. And I think we've all experienced this at some time in our life, this sense of flow. The psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, I think that's his name, pronouncing his name, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, he describes it as this, and he was the psychologist who really kind of promoted this idea of flow. He writes, "The ego falls away. Time flies. Every action, movement, and thought follows inevitably from the previous one, like playing jazz. Your whole being is involved, and you are using your skills to the utmost." Buddhas do not necessarily know they are Buddhas. They don't say, "I'm a Buddha, and you're a sentient being." Because how could that make any sense? That would mean that Buddhas are somehow separate from sentient beings. Buddhas fully realize, fully actualize their boundless intimacy with sentient beings, with the myriad things, and the activity of the Buddhas is compassion. So let's go on a little bit more. "When you see forms or hear sounds, fully engaging body and mind, you intuit Dharma intimately, like things and their reflections in the mirror, and unlike the moon and its reflection in the water. When one side is illuminated, the other side is dark." Well, how do we fully engage body and mind? Well, we allow forms and sounds to just pour into us. We meet them fully without judgment or evaluation as just this moment of our life. Like in our Zazen, right? We return. We return to body and breath. And in this way, we begin to settle into the space of just being fully present. The sound of traffic, the blue-gray color of the walls, the body sensations of sitting upright, all of these just pour in unmitigated, a direct experience. And time again, of course, thoughts arise, but we just gently come back to being thoroughly present, allowing the myriad things to come forward. Everything is available to us. Everything is available to wake us up. In longer retreats, we can sometimes experience this hearing or seeing with the whole body, the whole mind. But there are times, I think, also in our daily life as well. For me, for example, on occasion when I go on for a long walk or hike in the wild, at times there's just the forest, just the rock in front of me, or the small plant. And the complaining mind or the tired body just drop away. Fully engaging body and mind. you intuit Dharma intimately. Unlike things in the reflection in the mirror, and unlike the moon and its reflection in the water, when one side is illuminated, the other is dark. Well, this is a really puzzling line of Dogen, I'll frankly say. I've read a number of commentaries, but anyway, let me give you my 2 cents worth. The mirror and the water reflect something that's in front of them. In other words, something outside. They're both still, yet they reflect something that's out there. So I think, Dogen's, there's this sense of me doing, me seeing. In some way, me is present. But when dharmas are intuited intimately, when whole body and the whole mind is fully engaged, there's just intuiting, just intimacy. Not the sound and the hearer, the seen and the seer. Just seeing, just hearing. I should say that dark in Chinese Buddhist tradition carries the meaning of unity of all things. When we fully engage body and mind in our life, when the moment is illuminated, everything else, the whole universe, is represented as dark. And yet, present. Each moment of life, as we do dishes, for example, we tuck in the kids, we feed the dog, simultaneously, when we do this wholeheartedly, simultaneously, the whole of reality is embraced. Although our activity only illuminates the washing dishes, the tucking in of the kids, the feeding of the dog, and we're not really cognizant of all else. But it works like this. In the poem that we chant quite often in our Sunday service, The Merging of Difference and Unity, composed by Shurto, there's a beautiful couplet. And it goes like this. In the light there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark, the myriad things and oneness, Shurto tells us, are not two. Realizing all the myriad things are without a separate self, the truth of all forms merging in the dark, with nothing left out, is apparent. So here's my illustration of this. Perhaps it's like a cloudy and moonless night on the mountainside. All the trees, the bushes, the rocks, the creatures are there, and yet their unique forms merge completely in the dark. Light and dark. The myriad things and unity. This great mystery. How should we approach this? How should we approach this? Well, the following passage opens this up for us. But I'll leave that as a cliffhanger for next week, rather than trying to enter that now. So for next week, we'll pick up at number 4. So let me just kind of stop the sharing for now. Right. Well, I realize this passage of Dogen's is, even though we've only done a few, they're very rich because they're pretty deep. He's trying to explain things using poetic language. It's quite challenging. But that's okay. I think as we explore it over the next couple of weeks, there'll be greater clarity. And I encourage you, as I mentioned last week, to please read the text several times this week as well. And I'd like you to do one more thing as you read this time. This is a little homework assignment. I'd like you to find a phrase, a word or a phrase that maybe touches you in some way, speaks to you in some way, even if you don't understand it, and maybe especially if you don't understand it. A phrase, a word from this text. And I'd like you to kind of return to it throughout the week. Maybe mumble it to yourself before you begin Zazen in the morning. Hold it as something special. Make it a kind of touchstone for yourself in this coming week and see, after a week of practice, what it says to you. But carry it gently, not trying to intellectually bash it through, just like you would hold something precious. Okay, so we have some minutes left. And I think what I'd like to do, I'd like to put you into groups with a simple question. And the question will be, I'd like you to talk about in your own life when you experience flow, that sense of being totally immersed in what you're doing, when the sense of time drops away, as Chikenpi Sai says, and you're just totally engaged. It seems to just naturally one thing flow to another. Whatever you in your life, what brings that forward. So you maybe talk about that a little bit within your group, and then does that help illustrate or help understand, in what ways it help you understand Dogen's words that we've just been talking about? And if nothing comes to mind about that, that's fine. You don't have to focus on that. But you can talk about something else, perhaps, that you have heard or read from what we have just, the three sections we've just looked at. Okay? So with that in mind, if anyone needs to go, if you could go now, and we'll put the rest of the people into groups. I see we don't have a lot of time, so I'll put you in the groups of three, and each person... Let's see, two, three. Each person will get about 3 minutes to talk. And please self-time. Okay, perfect. Okay. Here we go, and I'll call you back in 9 minutes.
It's just you and me.
Oh, this keeps happening. I think it's because you are the Eno and I should have taken you off somehow. But that's
because
okay.
I'm the co-host.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I need to kind of.
I can make you the host and then I guess that's when I can disappear.
Well, why don't we just talk?
Okay.
How's that?
That makes me happy.
Yeah.
Of course.
So I just need to keep an eye on the time. 45, okay.
45.
Yeah, I'm just checking my time, so that's okay. So, Carmen, why don't you talk? What about flow? Or something else?
Well, you know, what came to my mind in this particular situation is when I'm swimming in the ocean and there's not any... It's not like swimming laps in the pool, because there isn't any end. It's not any end. So, And this, and it, what just came to my mind is this particular place where I like to swim on Cortez Island, which is a flat spot down these big cliffs. I can only swim there when the tide is up